My name is Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, and I wear two hats in politics. The first hat is editor of Politics First, which is the official publication of the UK Houses of Parliament. It is a publication written by MPs and peers and read by MPs and peers, and includes contributions from the Prime Minister, the Defence Secretary, the Leader of the Opposition, and prominent backbenchers. My second hat in politics is as a expert on Russia and the rest of the former Soviet Union. My PhD is in Russian history. I also specialize in the former Yugoslavia. And I give television interviews, I give speeches, I write articles. And indeed, I have just finished writing a book on contemporary Russian foreign policy.
I think before we start, I'd be interested to hear what you make of what many of us are now calling Russophobia, because so many news stories now seem to be being cooked up, literally manufactured, to paint Russia in a bad light, to smear in some ways. I'm not saying he's an angel, he certainly isn't, but, you know, to smear the character of Vladimir Putin, which is very interesting in that, you know, if you speak to British people about how popular our politicians are in Britain, they are nowhere near as popular in a literal and honest sense that the Putin is in Russia. And so I wonder, what do you make of this, what I call Russophobia, Marcus?
What we are seeing today in Britain, Tony, vis-a-vis Russia, is not without precedent. Ever since diplomatic relations were established between Britain and Russia in the 1500s, embedded in Westminster, embedded in Whitehall, is what we can call Russophobia, or we can simply call it racism towards Russians. Over hundreds of years, this prejudice about the Russian race, this loathing of the Russian race, this conviction that the Russian race are at best semi-human, has manifested itself over many, many years. If we have a look during the Crimea, during the Crimean War, the way British parliamentarians, the way British journalists were depicting Russia and the Russian people is very, very similar to how Russia and the Russian people are being depicted today in Britain. So it has a very long established history. Ultimately, it stems from the conviction of the British establishment, by which I mean the core of the British establishment, that the world is divided between East and West, between tyranny and freedom, between barbarism and civilization. And Britain believes that it inherited the baton, so to speak, from ancient Greece in defending the West from Asiatic barbarism. I say Britain because, of course, Britain is the core of the Anglo-Saxon world. America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand are Anglo-Saxon countries. The core of the American establishment is overwhelmingly of British ancestry, English, Scots-Irish, or Scottish. So, yes, Russia is being targeted viciously in Britain, politically, economically, but this is not unique. This has a very long history in Britain.
I wonder, you know, because it seems as if militarily the Russians are really able to flex their muscles a little bit now. They don't tend to do it, but when they do, it's pretty decisive. And also looking at these hypersonic missiles that Putin has developed, which are also potentially nuclear tipped, it looks as almost as if it's almost impossible to beat Russia in a military fashion, as Hitler found out back in the Second World War. That very much, I think, still is still the case today. But maybe this is something to do with you know, ways of getting at Russia which are not in a military fashion. Also, I suppose, economic sanctions as well after the Skripal case. So what do you make of those other two types of ways that, that the West is having pops at Russia economically and, you know, in other ways?
Well, in 2020, Russia is again a superpower. Under Vladimir Putin, Russia has resurrected much of its Soviet-era superpower status. I'm certainly not saying that the Russian Federation is overall a superpower in the same sense that the Soviet Union was, but certainly it is the case that as each year goes past, Russia is moving towards being the superpower that it was in Soviet times. The Russian nuclear arsenal is by far the largest in the world. The Russian military is, again, a force to be reckoned with, is a superpower. Since 2007, the Russian defense budget has been awash with money, which of course largely stems from Russia's status in the world as an energy superpower. However, the weakness of the Russian Federation is its economy. I say that because whilst Russia is an energy superpower and is second only to America in regard to defense exports in the world, the Russian economy is not a diversified one. It relies overwhelmingly on the aforementioned areas, energy and selling weapons abroad. So that is what the West is hoping to achieve by placing sanctions on Russia. But that said, in 2014, when America and the European Union chose to impose sanctions on Russia following the crisis in Ukraine, which was instigated by a pro-Western coup in the country, which had been orchestrated by Washington and London. I was of the opinion, Tony, that yes, there would be short-term pain for the Russian economy, but in the long term, it would benefit the Russian economy. Why? Because prior to the sanctions, Russia was importing products from Western countries that it should never have been importing in the first place. So these sanctions have actually given an opportunity to the Russian domestic market. And because of that, 6 years on, we see that the Russian domestic market has benefited tremendously from the West sanctions. Of course, the West didn't mean that to happen. You know, inadvertently, their sanctions have given an opportunity to the Russian domestic market. And because of that, Russian national security has been augmented even further.
Interesting. Well, what about Belarus, though? Because that's been in the news recently. It's a little, it's in the sort of the northern part of Europe. It's not often talked about or known about, but it's been in the news massively over the last month or so since Lukashenko's successful election there. I suppose the first question, Marcus, is, you know, how honest an election was that in a country which, you know, is dominated by Lukashenko? And one would imagine that it's not too difficult for him to actually fix an election.
Let me set the scene, first of all, Tony, by saying that the Soviet Union was not a prison of peoples, as is alleged by British and American politicians and journalists. In March 1991, Mikhail Gorbachev held a referendum in the Soviet Union in which the Soviet people were asked, do they wish to preserve the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics? 76% of the Soviet people chose to vote in the affirmative, namely to preserve the USSR. So that on its own demonstrates that the Soviet Union was not a prison of peoples. And in Belarus, the percentage of people who voted to preserve the USSR was in excess of 80%. Now, Belarus, or to give it its proper historical name, Belorussia, meaning White Russia, has been led by Alexander Lukashenko since 1994. Alexander Lukashenko is an authoritarian leader, but that is in the DNA of all Russian leaders. Russia, Belarus, we're talking about the same people. Belarusians are Russians. Belarus and Russia have to be run in an authoritarian manner. That might not be to the taste of people in Britain and America, but when Russia is led by weak individuals such as Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, the country collapses. Now, Alexander Lukashenko prevented the catastrophe which befell Russia in the 1990s from striking in Belarus, because he ensured that the Belarusian economy would be, largely speaking, a state-run economy. He did not allow privatization, in particular shock therapy, to come about in Belarus in the 1990s, and he prevented the emergence of oligarchs. So because of that, Alexander Lukashenko, from 1994 to the present, is a genuinely popular leader. He ensures that Belarus has one of the most stable of societies in Europe. People there all have jobs. They all have homes. There is no homelessness. There is barely any crime. People are paid their salaries on time. People are paid pensions. The healthcare is free and excellent. Transportation is very, very affordable and is excellent. So Alexander Lukashenko has been re-elected as president for all these years now because he's genuinely popular amongst the Belarusian people.
So why all this criticism from almost every news outlet in the West saying they believe that he has fixed this election, that he's not a legitimate president?
Well, first of all, America and Britain are not sincere when they say they are committed to democracy and human rights. That is simply an untenable argument for anyone to make. If America and Britain were genuinely committed to those concepts, then they would not have strategic partnerships with some of the most appalling, some of the most wicked of countries in the world, such as Saudi Arabia. No. What the West, Britain, America, have been doing in on the territory of the former Soviet Union for nearly 20 years now, or what Russia calls the near abroad, is orchestrating a number of coups in order to weaken Russia's position on the territory of the former Soviet Union. The near abroad is the number one priority for Russian foreign policy. If Russia loses its predominant position in the near abroad, then Russia has no hope whatsoever of being a superpower. That is why, after Vladimir Putin came to the helm of power in Russia, he dictated that the number one foreign policy objective for Russia would be to secure the near abroad. And Russia today, with the exception of the Baltic states and Ukraine, is the predominant outside force in Belarus, in the South Caucasus, and in Central Asia. But nonetheless, the West have been successful in bringing about coups in the former Soviet Union. So we had the coup in Georgia in 2003. We had the coup in Ukraine in 2004. We had a coup in Kyrgyzstan in 2005. And most notably of all, the coup in Ukraine in 2014.
Marcus, yes. Let me just stop you, because didn't you say something about a coup in Ukraine in 2004 there? Did you mean somewhere else?
No. What the West called the Orange Revolution. They call them the Color Revolution. So you have the West talks about a Rose Revolution, a Tulip Revolution, then an Orange Revolution. But in reality, these so-called color revolutions in the former Soviet Union have been simply coups organized by Washington and London. Now, the Orange Revolution, which brought Viktor Yushchenko to power at the beginning of 2005, failed because Viktor Yanukovych, who was more at one with Russia, came to power 5 years later in 2010. But then the West struck back in Ukraine at the beginning of 2014. And they have been successful because the West, because Ukraine is now integrating with the West politically, economically, culturally, and militarily. And this poses
so the West have been biding its time, really, even a decade after the first attempt at the coup.
Yes.
There was a successful one.
Absolutely. They learnt their mistakes following the coming to power of their man, Viktor Yushchenko, in 2005. And we have to remember that the British and the Americans are extremely patient people. They are masters of propaganda. They are masters of strategy, and they are absolutely determined to weaken Russia in its backyard, so to speak. But their attempt to instigate a coup in Belarus, or I should really call it Belarussia, has failed, and it was destined to fail.
You mentioned the Caucasus there. We've had an outbreak of fighting in between Azerbaijan and one of the other countries in Nagorno-Karabakh. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, the background to that and where you think that's heading?
Yes, certainly. So Nagorno-Karabakh is a disputed territory. De jure, it's part of Azerbaijan. De facto, it is ruled by Armenia. It is mainly populated by Armenians, but in Soviet times, it was a part of what was then known as the Azerbaijan SSR, Azerbaijan Soviet Socialist Republic.
Well, you know what? This reminds me very much of the context of the Crimea because again, under the Soviet leadership, there were quite a lot of important boundary changes,
yes,
which then sealed off particular ethnic groups from their natural home. Yes. Well, that didn't matter too much when you were within one enormous great Soviet republic.
Yes.
Now things,
yes,
are starting to break up. That,
yes,
is enormously important. I wonder if you think that might be playing a role here.
Yes, absolutely. You know, map making, internal borders, was something that was the brainchild of Lenin and was something that was opposed by Stalin. Stalin didn't want Soviet Russia to be called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. He wanted it to simply be called the Russian Federation. But of course, Lenin was in power and Lenin naturally had his way. And at one stage in the 1920s and early 1930s, the South Caucasus and parts of the North Caucasus was called Transcaucasia. But then they started to create Azerbaijan, Georgia, and then Armenia, and then you had these autonomous republics within the Russian Soviet Federal Socialist Republic, such as Chechnya, Dagestan, Ingushetia. But as you correctly said, Tony, those internal borders didn't mean anything in practice because the Soviet Union was a country. But of course, once the Soviet Union was dissolved, then those internal borders became overnight international borders. But what we've seen with Nagorno-Karabakh is a flare-up in violence. It's not a war. The chances of it breaking out into a war are very, very minimal because Russia has tremendous influence in Armenia and Azerbaijan. Both countries are in Russia's orbit, and indeed Azerbaijan in recent years has drifted further and further into Russia's orbit. So the chances of a war are very, very unlikely. There are flare-ups in violence over Nagorno-Karabakh between the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis. There was a flare-up in 2016. Russia will not allow a war to break out as a war broke out in the early 1990s, because a war in the South Caucasus could destabilize the North Caucasus, which is in the Russian Federation. And I've always described, Tony, the North Caucasus as Russia's Achilles heel. At the moment, there is peace there. There is stability there with Chechnya, Ingushetia, and Dagestan. But it is still quite a delicate region. And if there was an eruption of a full-blown war in the South Caucasus, that could very easily spill over into the North Caucasus in Russia. So that is another reason why Russia simply will not allow a war to break out between Armenia and Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh.
Now, this was always talked of as quite a potentially unstable area, particularly with the NATO member Turkey so close by.
Yes.
Do you think there's been much change in Turkey's attitude and relations with Russia? Because, you know, it was obvious, wasn't it, that a NATO country right near Russia was a potential flashpoint?
Yes, Russia and Turkey are traditional adversaries. A lot of commentators misunderstand the relationship today between Moscow and Ankara. They believe it is a relationship of affinity. You know, far from it. There is a mutual distrust. There is a mutual loathing between the Russians and the Turks. Both are regional rivals. During the 1990s, Turkey attempted to weaken Russia's position in the region, namely in the North Caucasus, by supporting Chechen militants of the nationalist kind and then of the Islamist kind. And likewise, Russia has attempted to weaken Turkey's position by having a long-standing relationship with the PKK. Russia provides political support for the PKK, provides logistical support, and provides weaponry to the PKK. Turkey has a very cordial relationship with Azerbaijan. The Azerbaijanis, largely speaking, are a Turkic people. And Turkey certainly has encouraged Azerbaijan to take military action against the Armenian military in Nagorno-Karabakh. And I believe, Tony, that Turkey is attempting to weaken Russia's hand in northwestern Syria, which is controlled by the Turks and Al-Qaeda. They're trying to weaken Russia's position there by trying to instigate a full-blown war in Russia's orbit. Because if a full-blown war did erupt between Armenia and Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh, and if it did spill into the North Caucasus, then of course Russia would be distracted from what's going on in Syria and would have to focus on solving the situation in the South Caucasus and also in the North Caucasus. So what we are seeing is a continuation of Russian-Turkish rivalry.
Fascinating. I mean, I look at this and I try and sometimes step back and, you know, get my big globe of the world, spin it round and think, well, look, here you've got a very powerful China economically, and in fact getting to the point where they've basically beaten the Americans at capitalism. Much, much cheaper, better goods they're producing at a much better value. And then there's obviously the United States, a big, powerful force in the world, very, very aggressive militarily, the two main superpowers. And I mean, obviously, there's the other NATO countries in Europe with the United States. But I wonder, what do you think Russia's role is between these two superpowers? Because it seems to me that maybe the Russians have been, because of US and British aggression, have been forced to become much closer to the Chinese. So rather than just being kind of a middleman, an arbiter in world affairs between those two superpowers, they now seem to be sort of switching their orbit slightly more towards the Chinese.
I wouldn't categorize China as a superpower. In economic terms, yes, it is a superpower, but it's an economic superpower with a foundation of glass or clay, because the Chinese economy is not producing what the German or the Japanese economy produces. It wouldn't take much for a country in the future to emerge, a country with a large population, to produce the cheap basic goods that China produces. But yes, China is an economic superpower. China is a regional superpower, but China's not a global superpower. And China, certainly in military terms, is not a superpower. I still refer to the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, as the largest armed forces museum in the world. Much of its equipment is obsolete. And China relies heavily on Russia for high-tech components, for advanced weapon systems. So that takes me on to Russia's relationship with China. Well, Russia, in order for Russia to maintain its resurrected superpower status in the world, Russia needs China. Russia needs to keep on supplying China with vast amounts of oil and gas, because, of course, China lacks oil and gas. And if the day comes when Russia can supply China with water, then Russia, the Russian revenues from having a relationship with China will surge upwards incredibly. So Russia needs China, but China needs Russia. Without Russia, then the Chinese economy would become hamstrung. So the relationship between China and Russia is not a relationship of affinity. It is what I call a relationship of necessity. For China to strive towards becoming a global superpower, they need Russia. They need Russian oil and gas, and they need advanced Russian weaponry. They need advanced Russian components. So, for example, the Chinese have a fifth generation aircraft. It flies, and that is a tremendous success by the Chinese. But they don't have the components for the cockpit. So at the moment, Tony, the Chinese are calling on the Russians to supply them with these components. The Russians haven't made a decision on that yet. So that takes me on to why. Because there is still suspicion between Beijing and Moscow between each other. Russia is conscious about China's growing might, including growing military might. So Russia doesn't really want to potentially build up a country which could become an adversary of Russia. Also, China is very suspicious at how Russia has an exceptionally close relationship with India and Vietnam, which is two of China's most problematic of countries in the world. And yes, you could call them foes. And there's the potential for a war between China and India, and also China and Vietnam. And Beijing knows that the reason why Vietnam and India have become so emboldened in recent years to stand up to China is because they are awash with Russian weaponry, including advanced weaponry. So it's a relationship of necessity between Moscow and Beijing. I see no reason in the foreseeable future, Tony, as to why that relationship of necessity will break down. But there are challenges. There are very serious challenges there. And the day could come when the relationship unravels. But for the foreseeable future, it won't happen.
Let's get back to Belarus, and their lockdown didn't happen, did it? What do you make of the claims by Lukashenko that the IMF offered him nearly $1 billion in bribes in order to have a lockdown? I didn't realise that the IMF had this kind of authority to give money. I mean, I suppose they would say, well, this is to compensate you if you have a lockdown, but you won't get it if you don't do a lockdown.
Well, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, which is more commonly known as, is not an independent body. It is one of the most potent weapons of the American government. And it's certainly the case that the Americans attempted and have attempted over the last few years to try and cause a wedge between Belarus and Russia. And yes, they attempted to bribe Lukashenko as a way of attempting to gain a foothold in Belarus. But Lukashenko was never going to allow the West to have a foothold in Belarus. And he knew as well that because Belarus is de facto a province of the Russian Federation, or is a Russian protectorate, that was never going to happen. But nonetheless, he was approached by the Americans. The reason they attempted to bribe him was to gain a foothold in Belarus. Lukashenko does not believe that what is known as COVID-19 warrants social distancing, let alone a lockdown. And what we see in Belarus is a country which has been going about its normal day-to-day business completely undeterred, by this, as I say, what is known as COVID-19, which has wrecked economic carnage in much of the world, and in particular in Western countries.
Well, look, Ian Birrell in the Mail on Sunday, he was saying that the figures for deaths from COVID-19 as a percentage of population were in Belarus were 1/7 of what they were in the UK. So the actual death rate of the population due to COVID-19 was 7 times bigger in the UK than in Belarus. Well, you know, can that be believed? Because they didn't have a lockdown at all.
Well, I would take it one step further, Tony, and say the figures which are put forward by the British government and put out by or spun by British mainstream media are figures which have never been properly corroborated. They certainly haven't been independently corroborated. I'm not going to accept the words of scientists who act as advisors to the British government, or medical doctors who act as advisors to the British government. Why? Because these are not independent parties. And of course, recently we heard the news that the chief scientific advisor to the British government, Patrick Vallance, has shares to the tune of £500,000 in a pharmaceutical company, which is bidding, or perhaps it already has been given the contract, to develop a vaccine for what is known as COVID-19. So these people are not independent. If this was a court of law would not rule them as independent parties. Yes, we can listen to what they have to say, but they're not independent because they are acting because of the capacity in which they are acting in.
Okay, so the interesting news this week was that we had Dominic Raab imposing sanctions on Lukashenko over the treatment of protesters over in Minsk and in other cities. I mean, it is fair to say, isn't it, that the police have been particularly brutal with these protesters, and there are lots of evidence of people being beaten up in prison and that sort of thing.
Which country are we referring to now?
Belarus. In Belarus.
Well, number one, talk of 100,000 people, 200,000 people taken to the streets in Minsk, the capital of Belarus, was greatly exaggerated by Western politicians and Western media outlets. It's certainly the case that people did take to the streets. They had a right to do that. If Belarus was a dictatorship, then not one person would have taken to the streets. But yes, a few thousand people took to the streets. Was there violence? Yes, inevitably there was violence. There were certainly provocations by agent provocateurs who have been trained by the Americans and the British in Poland, in Ukraine, and in Lithuania and Latvia, as what happened in Ukraine, where the Ukrainian police in Kiev and the Ukrainian special police units, the Bakut, were provoked. So, yes, there was violence, but you have to ask who was provoking and why was there provocations. But in terms of people being taken to prisons and never being seen of again, well, has that been corroborated by British and American journalists? No, that hasn't been corroborated by them. But you must not allow a coup to take place against a legitimate president, against a legitimate government. The police are there for a reason. The military is there for a reason. If you're going to allow a coup to take place, well, you might as well not have a security apparatus in the first place. No, what the Americans and the British tried to achieve there was a coup using highly trained individuals in combat and also in media and in PR, and it failed, and it failed abysmally. The West knows that, Belarusian knows that, Russia knows that, and as a result of that, we are now seeing the emergence, the materialization, I should say, of the Union State of Russia and Belarus, which in lay terms is the reunification of Belarusia and Russia.
Amazing. Well, look, the irony of all this, of course, is Dominic Raab is accusing Lukashenko of human rights abuses, of police brutality, on the same week that we had the police shut down an anti-lockdown, anti-COVID measures demonstration on Saturday, which was timed because of the important vote taking place this week to renew the Coronavirus Act, which was only allowed to be on the statute book for 6 months. So that was a very, very, you know, obviously very important political demonstration that took place, but it was shut down by the police. Now, I understand you were there, Marcus. Is that true?
Indeed, I was. I attended the protest on Trafalgar Square. I wasn't at the protest in Hyde Park. It is believed that there was about 30 to 35,000 people in Trafalgar Square. I'm told by police officers that the maximum capacity on Trafalgar Square is about 30,000. Well, I can assure you from now, Tony, that it was full.
Okay, so can we just start by, if you can talk us through what you think some of the main issues around the legislation and the actions that have been being taken by the government under that act, and what you think some of the main issues that about that are, and then we'll talk in a minute about the actual day itself on Saturday.
Well, I'm very, very concerned and very, very angry by the powers in the Coronavirus Act, because essentially people's civil liberties, people's freedoms, people's jobs are threatened by this act. It is simply pointless, irrelevant, immaterial for people to say, ah, yes, but it's the act ensures that furlough will continue. Yes, but for how long? Furlough cannot continue indefinitely. No economy in the world can continue this. So what happens? What happens in 6 months' time? What happens in a year from now? These are very, very serious questions. And what we see emerging in Britain, and I have no problem in using this word, is tyranny, is a form of mass control. And I think the sooner that people, ordinary Britons, wake up to that, the better. And I applaud, Tony, the 100 or so Conservative MPs who have now chosen to speak out, who are now questioning the scientists and the medical doctors who surround the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. And indeed, they are calling for them in some instances to be sacked. And Sir Desmond Swain, a Conservative MP from the West Country, correctly said last night in the chamber, in the House of Commons, that COVID-19 is the 24th biggest killer in Britain. The 24th biggest killer. So why lockdowns? Why social distancing when it's the 24th biggest killer? That is a question that needs to be put, not just to Boris Johnson, but to the chief scientific advisor and to the chief medical advisor. They shouldn't be allowed to waffle. They shouldn't be allowed to try and evade the question. They need to be asked, why is the 24th biggest killer in Britain bringing about, why has it already brought about a national lockdown? Why does it threaten to bring about a second national lockdown? Why is it eroding civil liberties? Why is it destroying people's livelihoods?
Well, can you have a go at answering your own question? I mean, obviously must be some sort of lobby at work here somewhere if what you say is true.
I believe that the pharmaceutical industry, which exerts enormous leverage over the British government and the American government. But I should reword that, Tony. The pharmaceutical industry in both America and Britain is a vital component of the American establishment and the British establishment. And I believe this is an opportunity for them to introduce vaccinations, not just obviously for influenza, but obviously for what is known as COVID-19, and to achieve an astronomical amount of money. I think that is one. I think that is one explanation, and I think it's a very, very plausible explanation. I think the other explanation is that there are forces at play in Britain and America, in the Anglo-Saxon countries, which want to introduce artificial intelligence, a dreadful invention, absolutely appalling invention, into the global economy, for it to become the dominant element in society as we know it. And all the evidence from this year points to AI emerging in that way that I believe that the powers that be in Britain and America would like it to manifest itself in. So I think those are two explanations for what we are seeing. And I no doubt as well, it's an opportunity to exert even more control over society.
This is interesting, isn't it, that these issues affect many millions, tens of millions of people in the UK, so it's quite legitimate for you know, a handful of them in comparison to come out on the streets in Trafalgar Square to lobby for their retaining their freedoms against these, you know, pharmaceutical industry and artificial intelligence. So anyway, how did it go on Saturday?
I was on Trafalgar Square, Tony, and I assure you and I assure your listeners, it was a peaceful protest. It was professionally organized. It was professionally managed. And it was a very, very touching protest. At the very beginning, Christian prayers were held for the slain police officer in Croydon. A minute's silence was held for the police officer who lost his life in the line of duty in Croydon. And a Christian prayer was held for police officers in Britain who have been put on the front line to enforce these shockingly dreadful measures against the ordinary British man, woman, and child. It was a very peaceful, a very humane protest. However, towards the end, something snapped as regards the police, and specifically the riot police. They came onto the stage. They effectively shut down the protest by preventing the speakers who hadn't spoken yet to speak. And then they started to approach protesters and they started lashing out at protesters. I can tell you that from now, Tony, that there was violence at the end, but that it was instigated by the police. The photographs demonstrate that. The footage in the form of videos demonstrates that. It's there on the internet. Of course, mainstream media won't make reference to those photographs and to the videos, but then they're not going to. British mainstream media is neither free nor independent. It is an essential part of the British establishment, and indeed it is at the core of the British establishment. But it was a peaceful protest. The violence broke out at the end because of actions of the police.
Now, the much of that media has accused the speakers, for example, David Icke there, of being COVID deniers. And, of course, they're right, aren't they? David Icke himself in April said COVID-19 doesn't exist. There is no COVID-19.
Mm. Well, that's his opinion. I mean, you know, I'm under the impression that Britain is a liberal democracy in which people have the right to express an opinion, that people have the right to protest. Unless, of course, Britain is becoming like Saudi Arabia, dear old Saudi Arabia, which is a historic friend and ally of Britain. But David Icke is entitled to his opinion. And people who believe that COVID-19 exists are equally entitled to that opinion as well. But I find it most disconcerting that we are now being told that you have to have one opinion about COVID-19, that it exists and that it warrants social distancing, that it warranted a national lockdown earlier this year, and that if need be, it warrants another second national lockdown. Well, if people want to believe that, they can believe that, and I respect that. But if people choose to have a different opinion on the matter, then they have every right. Because if they don't, then Britain, alas, is no longer a liberal democracy.
One does wonder whether there is a little bit of over-egging of the pudding, certainly, whether this is another kind of Project Fear, a little bit like the Remainers Project Fear from Brexit. I mean, this does. I mean, the media can be used, can't it, Marcus, to do this? As we know, that fear is an extremely powerful weapon to use in order to control populations.
Absolutely. And I cite once again the Conservative MP, Sir Desmond Swain, who, when he was in the chamber, he used that expression, Project Fear. He used that against the government. He used that against the chief scientific advisor, the chief medical advisor to the government. And of course, the media is part and parcel of having and continuing to petrify the British public. But then, as I said moments ago, Britain does not have a free and independent media. When it comes to anything to do with British foreign policy, British mainstream media backs British foreign policy objectives. And now, when it comes to COVID-19 and everything associated with it, British mainstream media is going along with it, largely speaking. Though I would say that The Telegraph and The Daily Mail is now running interviews, is running articles, is running columns, which are finally questioning the British government's narrative on COVID-19 and in many cases castigating the British government's stance on COVID-19.
So I noticed one of the Telegraph columnists was suspended yesterday from Twitter, or maybe it was even this morning she woke up, yes, to find that she was no longer allowed to be on Twitter for, yes, saying that actually the best thing that students can do is to catch a virus that they're not likely at all to die from and probably won't even get slightly ill in order to help the rest of us with herd immunity. That doesn't seem to be allowed now. So I think, you know, maybe there is some traction going on in the mainstream, you know, certain parts of the mainstream press. The bizarre situation is, though, of course, that we've got an opposition that isn't actually opposing these measures. They're saying that the measures should be more draconian rather than less, which I find quite laughable. But anyway, look, there is some good media. Yes, I think we can both agree most of the mainstream press in the UK is bought and paid for by the deep state and certainly by the bankster oligarchy. But whereabouts can we go, Marcus, to find good info, particularly on this biggest story of the year, the coronavirus and the COVID and all the things associated with it, particularly to get expert opinion from doctors, much of which is being censored by social media, by Google, YouTube, and Facebook, etc., and by the mainstream press?
I urge the British public to be open-minded. I urge them to listen to both sides of the story. I urge them to listen to what the British government has to say, to listen to what British mainstream media has to say. And at the same time, listen to shows such as your one, Tony. Listen to alternative media, for example, Press TV or RT or Sputnik. Listen to what esteemed experts in their field have to say about what is known as COVID-19, by which I mean some of the world's most esteemed virologists. Listen to what they have to say.
Okay, so can you name us some publications, websites, or specific doctors we should be looking out for?
Well, in terms of media outlets, I would say that there are some very good opinions, some very good articles and interviews being run on The Telegraph. I know that might sound strange, but there are. Likewise, with the Daily Mail or the Mail Online, I do believe they are places that people should be referring themselves to in order to get a more balanced opinion. There is a German doctor who was set to speak at the protest on Saturday, a doctor, Dr. Heiko.
He was the main doctor in this kind of Doctors of Enlightenment group in Germany, who were saying some pretty shocking stuff, saying that the mainstream media in Germany was the Goebbels media, and that the government was behaving like a fascist government in Germany.
Yeah, correct. These are people whom I would urge the British public to listen to. If you don't want to agree with them, that's
fine. These are surgeons and GPs, these people. They're not, sort of pundits, or they haven't got an axe to grind, it doesn't appear.
Well, absolutely. Providing people draw a conclusion based on having considered both sides of the story, I'm fine with that. Even if I disagree with it, I'm fine with that. Providing it's an informed opinion. But for the sake of society as we know it in Britain, for the sake of liberal democracy in Britain, people must listen to both sides of the argument.
I think you should wind up by plugging your own site, Marcus.
Well, look, I'm certainly not a medical doctor. I'm certainly not a scientist. But I have said from the very beginning of the lockdown and social distancing measures that the alarm bells, Tony, ring in my head when mainstream media does not offer a platform to experts in their fields. That can be about virology, that can be about Russia, that can be about Iran, that can be about Venezuela. Because when they do not offer a platform to experts who have a different opinion, I have to ask, why are they not offering them a platform? What is it they're frightened about? So the fact that some of the world's most distinguished virologists are not appearing on Sky News or Channel 4 News or BBC News is a source of great concern for me. So in terms of COVID-19, that's what I would say to your viewers. That's what I would say to people on Twitter who follow me. I would say, ask that question. Why are experts, leading experts in their fields, not being invited onto Sky News, for example, to express their opinion about what is known as COVID-19.
Okay. And what about your, how do people follow your work, Marcus?
I'm on Twitter at Dr. Marcus P. I'm on Facebook, Marcus Papadopoulos. All of my television interviews, including mainstream media television interviews, are uploaded on my YouTube channel, which is Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos.
Well, Marcus, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Tony. Thank you for having had me on.